Chapter 48. When Pitt returned to his hangar in Washington, he was pleasantly surprised to find Julia waiting in his apartment above the car collection. After a hug and a kiss, she presented him with a margarita on the rocks made the right way, without the sweet mix and crushed ice popular in most restaurants. "You are so nice to come home to," he said happily.
"I couldn't think of a more comfortable and secure place to stay," she said, smiling seductively.
She was wearing a blue leather miniskirt with a tan nylon mesh one-shoulder top. "I can see why. The grounds outside are crawling with security guards.
Courtesy of the INS.
I hope they're more alert than the last group," he said, sipping the margarita and giving an approving nod.
"Did you fly in from Louisiana alone?"
Pitt nodded. "Al is in a local hospital having a cast put on his broken leg. Admiral Sandecker and Rudy Gunn came in earlier to make a report directly to the president."
"Peter Harper filled me in about your heroics on the Mississippi. You prevented a national disaster and saved countless lives. The newspapers and TV news programs are filled with stories of terrorists blowing up the levee and the battle between the United States and the National Guard. The whole country was rocked by the event. Strangely, there was no mention of you or Al."
"Just the way we like it." He raised his head and sniffed the air. "What's that appetizing aroma I smell?"
"My Chinese dinner for the party tonight."
"What's the occasion?"
"St. Julian Perlmutter called just before you returned and said he thinks he and Hiram Yeager have the inside track on a solution to the disappearance of Chin Chang's treasure ship. He said he intensely dislikes meeting in government buildings, so I invited him for dinner to hear his revelations. Peter Harper is coming, and I also sent invitations to Admiral Sandecker and Rudy Gunn. I hope they can find time to come."
"They're fans of St. Julian," said Pitt, smiling. "They'll be here."
"They'd better, or you'll be eating leftovers for 2 weeks."
"I couldn't have had a nicer homecoming," said Pitt, embracing Julia and squeezing the breath out of her.
"Whew," she said, wrinkling her nose. "When was the last time you bathed?"
"It's been a few days. Except for diving in swamp water, I haven't had the opportunity to jump in a shower since I last saw you on the Weehawken." Julia rubbed the reddish blush on one of her cheeks.
"Your beard is like sandpaper. Hurry and pretty up. Everyone will be showing up in another hour."
"Your presentation is magnificent," said Perlmutter, eyeing the array of delectable dishes Julia had prepared buffet-style and set out on an antique credenza in Pitt's dining room.
"It looks absolutely scrumptious," said Sandecker.
"I couldn't have described it better," added Gunn.
"My mother took special pains to teach me to cook, and my father was a lover of fine Chinese food prepared with a French influence," said Julia, basking in the flattery.
She had changed into a red Lycra jersey tube dress and looked stunning amid the room full of 5 men.
"I hope you don't leave INS to open a restaurant," joked Harper.
"Not much chance of that. I have a sister who owns a restaurant in San Francisco, and it's a hard job with long hours in a small, hot kitchen. I'd rather have freedom of movement."
Helping themselves and gathering around a table built from a cabin roof off a 19th-century sailing ship, they dug into Julia's feast with great anticipation. She didn't disappoint them. The compliments flowed and bubbled like fine champagne. During dinner, the talk purposely skirted Perlmutter's findings and centered instead around the events on the Mystic Canal levee and the Army Corps efforts to repair the damage. All hated the idea of the United States being scrapped as she lay, and expressed the hope that necessary funding would be found to save and refit her, if not for voyaging, then as a floating hotel and casino, as originally proposed. Harper filled them in on the indictments being handed down against Chin Chang. Despite his influence and the reluctance of the president and some congressmen, the charges of criminal conduct rolled over any opposition. For dessert, Julia served fried apples with syrup. After dinner was finished and Pitt had helped Julia clear the dishes and load them in the dishwasher, Everyone settled in his living room, filled with nautical antiques, maritime paintings, and ship models. Sandecker lit up one of his big cigars without asking permission, while Pitt poured them all a glass of 40-year-old port.
"Well, St. Julian," said Sandecker, "what is this great discovery Pitt tells me you made?"
"I'm also interested in hearing how you think it concerns the INS," Harper said to Pitt. Pitt held up his port and stared at the dark liquid as if it was a crystal ball.
"If St. Julian puts us on the wreck of a ship called the Princess Doan, it will alter the relationship between the U.S. and China for decades to come."
"Forgive me if I say that sounds wildly improbable," said Harper.
Pitt grinned. "Wait, and you shall see."
Perlmutter eased his bulk into a big chair and opened his briefcase, retrieving several files.
"First, a little history to enlighten those of you who don't yet know exactly what it is we're talking about."
He paused to open the first file and pull out several papers.
"Let me begin by saying that rumors concerning the passenger ship Princess Doan as leaving Shanghai with a vast cargo of historical Chinese art treasures in November of 1948 are true."
"What was your source?" asked Sandecker.
"Name is Hui Wei, a former Nationalist Army colonel who served under Chiang Kai-shek. Wei now lives in Taipei. He fought the communists until forced to flee to Taiwan when it was called Formosa. He's 92 years old, but with a memory sharp as a razor. He vividly recalled following orders by Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek to empty the museums and palaces of every art treasure they could lay their hands on. Private collections belonging to the rich were also seized, along with any and all wealth found in bank vaults. All of it was packed in wooden crates and trucked to the Shanghai docks. There it was loaded on board an old passenger liner that was commandeered by one of Chiang Kai-shek's generals, whose name was Kung Hui. He seems to have dropped off the face of the earth the same time as the Princess Doan, so there is every reason to believe he was on her. More treasure was seized than the ship could ordinarily hold, but since the Princess Doan had been stripped of her furnishings and fixtures in preparation for her final voyage to the scrappers in Singapore, Kung Hui managed to cram over 1,000 crates into the cargo holds and empty passenger staterooms. Most of the crates with large sculptures were tied down on the open decks. Then, on November 2nd, 1948, the Princess Doan sailed from Shanghai into oblivion."
"Vanished?" said Gunn.
"Like a midnight ghost."
"When you say historical art treasures," said Rudy Gunn, "is it known exactly what pieces were seized?"
"The ship's manifest, if there was one," answered Perlmutter, "would make every curator in every museum of the world mad with envy and desire. A brief catalogue would include the monumental designs of Shang Dynasty bronze weapons and vases. From 1600 until 1100 BC, Shang artists were advanced in the carving of stone, jade, marble, bone, and ivory. There were the writings of Confucius inscribed in wood in his own hand from the Chou Dynasty that reigned from 1100 to 200 B.C. Magnificent bronze sculptures, incense burners inlaid with rubies, sapphires, and gold, life-size chariots with drivers and six horses, and beautifully lacquered dishes from the Han Dynasty, 206 B.C. to 220 A.D. Exotic ceramics, books from China's classical poets and paintings by their masters living in the Tang Dynasty, 618 to 907 A.D. Beautifully created artifacts from the Sung, Yuan, and the famous Ming Dynasty, whose artisans were masters at sculptures and carvings. Their workmanship is widely known for the decorative arts, including cloisonné, furniture and pottery, and, of course, we're all familiar with their famous blue and white porcelain."
Sandecker studied the smoke that curled from his cigar.
"You make it sound more valuable than the Inca treasure Dirk found in the Sonoran Desert." "Like comparing a cup of rubies to a carload of emeralds," Perlmutter said, sipping his port. "Impossible to set a value on such a grand hoard. Money-wise, you're talking billions of dollars. But as historical treasure, the word priceless becomes inadequate.
I can't imagine riches of such magnitude, said Julia wonderingly.
There's more, Perlmutter said quietly, adding to the spell. The icing on the cake. What the Chinese would consider as their crown jewels.
More precious than rubies and sapphires, said Julia, or diamonds and pearls?
Something far more rare than mere baubles, Perlmutter said softly. The bones of Peking man.
Good Lord!
Sandecker expelled a breath. You're not suggesting that the Peking man was on the Princess Doan?
I am, Perlmutter nodded.
Colonel Hui Wei swore that an iron box containing the long-lost remains were placed on board the Princess Doan in the captain's cabin minutes before the ship sailed.
My father often spoke of the missing bones, said Julia. Chinese adoration of our ancestors made them more meaningful than tombs still containing early emperors.
Sandecker sat up and gazed at Perlmutter. The saga behind the loss of the Peking man's fossilized bones remains one of the great unexplained enigmas of the 20th century.
You're familiar with the story, Admiral? Asked Gunn.
I once wrote a paper on the missing bones of Peking man at the Naval Academy. I thought they vanished in 1941 and were never found. But St. Julian is now saying they were seen 7 years later on the Princess Doan before she set sail.
Where did they come from? Asked Harper.
Perlmutter nodded at Sandecker and deferred.
You wrote the paper, Admiral.
Sinanthropus picanensis. Sandecker spoke the words almost reverently. Chinese man of Peking. A very ancient and primitive human who walked upright on 2 feet. In 1929, the discovery of his skull was announced by a Canadian anatomist, Dr. Davidson Black, who directed the excavation and was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. Over the next several years, digging in a quarry that had once been a hill with limestone caves near the village of Jokochen, Black found thousands of chipped stone tools and evidence of hearths, which indicated Peking man had mastered fire. Excavations carried out over the next 10 years found the partial remains of another 40 individuals, both juveniles and adults, and what has been acknowledged as the largest hominid fossil collection ever assembled.
Any relation to Java man who was found 30 years sooner? Asked Gunn.
When the Java and Peking skulls were compared in 1939, they were seen to be very similar, with Java man arriving on the scene a shade earlier and not as sophisticated in tool-making as Peking man.
Since scientific dating techniques didn't come into play until much later, said Harper, is there any idea as to how old Peking man is?
Because he cannot be scientifically dated until he's refound, the best guess to his age is between 700,000 and 1 million years. New discoveries in China, however, indicate that Homo erectus, an early species of human, is now thought to have migrated out of Africa to Asia 2 million years ago. Naturally, Chinese paleoanthropologists hope to prove that early man evolved in Asia and migrated to Africa instead of the accepted other way around.
How did the remains of Peking man disappear? Julia asked Sandecker.
In December of 1941, invading Japanese troops were closing in on Peking, narrated Sandecker. Officials at the Peking Union Medical College, where the irreplaceable bones of Peking man were stored and studied, decided they should be removed to a place of safety. It was also evident, more so in China than in the West, that war between Japan and the United States was imminent. American and Chinese scientists agreed that the fossils should be sent to the United States for safekeeping until after the war. After months of negotiation, the American ambassador in Peking finally arranged shipment by a detachment of U.S. Marines that was under orders to sail for the Philippines. The ancient bones were carefully packed in 2 Marine Corps footlockers, and along with the Marines were put aboard a train bound for the port city of Chanchin.
where both living and dead were to board the SS President Harrison, a passenger ship belonging to the American President Lines. The train never arrived in Tientsin. It was halted by Japanese troops who ransacked it. By now it was December the 8th, 1941, and the Marines, who had thought themselves neutrals, were then sent to Japanese prison camps to sit out the war. It can only be assumed that after lying underground for 1,000,000 years, the remains of Peking Man were scattered around the rice paddies beside the railroad track.
That was the last word on their fate? Harper inquired.
Sandecker shook his head and smiled. Myths thrived after the war. One had the fossil secretly hidden in a vault under the Museum of Natural History in Washington. The Marines who guarded the shipment and survived the war came up with at least 10 different stories of their own. The footlockers went down on a Japanese hospital ship that in reality was loaded with weapons and troops. The Marines buried the footlockers near an American consulate. They were hidden in a prisoner of war camp and then lost at the end of the war. They were stored in a Swiss warehouse, in a vault on Taiwan, in a closet of a Marine who smuggled them home. Whatever the true story, Peking Man is still lost in a fog of controversy. And how they somehow found their way into Chiang Kai-shek's hands and onto the Princess Dowan is anybody's guess.
All very tantalizing, said Julia, setting a pot of tea and cups on the center table for anyone who wanted some. But what good is all this if the princess can't be found?
Pitt smiled. Leave it to a woman to cut to the heart of the matter.
Any details surrounding her loss? Sandecker asked Perlmutter. On November 28th, she sent out a Mayday signal that was picked up in Valparaiso, Chile, giving her position as 200 miles west of the South American coast in the Pacific. A radio operator claimed a fire was raging in her engine room and she was rapidly taking on water. Ships in the general area were diverted to the location given, but the only trace that was ever found were several empty life jackets. Repeated signals from Valparaiso brought no response, and no extensive search was undertaken.
Gunn shook his head thoughtfully. You could look for years with the Navy's latest deep-sea penetrating technology and not find anything. A vague position like that means a search grid of at least 2,000 square miles.
Pitt poured himself a cup of tea. Was her destination known?
Perlmutter shrugged.
None was ever given nor determined.
He opened another file and passed around several photos of the Princess Dowan.
For her time, she was a pretty ship, observed Sandecker, admiring her lines.
Pitt's eyebrows raised in speculation. He rose from his chair, walked to a desk, and picked up a magnifying glass. Then he studied two of the photos closely before looking up. These two photos, he said slowly.
Yes,
Perlmutter murmured expectantly. They are not of the same ship.
You're absolutely right. One photo shows the Princess Dowan's sister ship, the Princess Yongtai.
Pitt stared into Perlmutter's eyes.
You're hiding something from us, you old fox.
I have no rock-hard proof, said the big history expert. But I do have a theory.
We'd all like to hear it, said Sandecker.
Out came another file from the briefcase.
I strongly suspect the distress signal received in Valparaiso was a fabrication that was probably sent by Chiang Kai-shek's agents either on land or from a fishing boat somewhere offshore. The Princess Dowan, while en route across the Pacific, was given a few minor modifications by her crew, including a name change. She became the Princess Yongtai, which had been broken up at the scrappers a short time before. Under her new disguise, she then continued toward her ultimate destination.
Very canny of you to fathom the substitution, said Sandecker.
Not at all,
Perlmutter replied modestly.
A fellow researcher in Panama discovered that the Princess Yung Tai passed through the canal only 3 days after the Princess Do Wan sent her Mayday signal.
Were you able to trace her course from Panama? Asked Pitt. Perlmutter nodded.
Thanks to Hiram Yeager, who used his vast computer complex to trace ship arrivals at ports up and down the eastern seaboard during the first and second week of December 1948. Bless his little heart, he struck gold. The records show a vessel passing through the Welland Canal listed as the Princess Yung Tai on December the 7th.
Sandecker's face lit up.
The Welland Canal separates Lake Erie from Lake Ontario. It does indeed, agreed Perlmutter.
My God, Gunn muttered. That means the Princess Do Wan didn't disappear in the ocean, but sank in one of the Great Lakes.
Who would have thought it? Sandecker said, more to himself than the others.
Quite a feat of seamanship to navigate a ship her size down the St. Lawrence River before the seaway was built, said Pitt. The Great Lakes, Gunn echoed the word slowly. Why would Chiang Kai-shek order a ship filled with priceless art treasures to go thousands of miles out of the way? If he wanted to hide the cargo in the United States, why not San Francisco or Los Angeles as a destination?
Colonel Hui Wei claimed he was not told the ship's final destination. But he did know that Chiang Kai-shek flew agents into the U.S. to arrange for the cargo to be unloaded and stored with the utmost secrecy. According to him, it was at the direction of officials at the State Department in Washington who set up the operation.
Not a bad plan, said Pitt. The main port terminals along the east and west coasts were too open. The dock workers would have known what they were unloading in a second. Word would have spread like wildfire. The communist leaders back in China would never have suspected their national treasures were to be smuggled into America's heartland and hidden. Seems to me a naval base would have been the obvious choice if they wanted secrecy, suggested Harper.
That would have taken a direct order from the White House, said Sandecker. They were already catching flack from communist Romania and Hungary for keeping their royal jewels in a Washington vault after the American army found them hidden in a salt mine in Austria immediately after the war.
Pitt said, Not a bad plan when you think about it. Communist Chinese intelligence agents would have put their money on San Francisco. They probably had agents crawling over the dock terminals around the bay waiting for the Princess Do Wan to steam under the Golden Gate Bridge, never dreaming the ship was actually headed for a port in the Great Lakes.
Yes, but what port? Said Gunn.
And on which lake? They all turned to Perlmutter.
I can't give you an exact location, he said candidly, but I do have a lead who might direct us to a ballpark location containing the wreck.
This person has information you don't? Asked Pitt unbelievingly.
He does.
Sandecker looked steadily at Perlmutter.
You've questioned him?
Not yet. I thought I'd leave that up to you.
How can you be sure he's reliable? Asked Julia.
Because he was an eyewitness.
Everyone stared openly at Perlmutter. Finally, Pitt asked the obvious question in their minds. He saw the Princess Do Wan go down?
Better yet, Ian Hong Kong Gallagher was the only survivor. He was the ship's chief engineer, so if anyone can provide details of the sinking, he can. Gallagher never went back to China, but remained in the States, eventually becoming a citizen and shipping out again on an American line before retiring.
Is he still living?
My very same question to Yeager, answered Perlmutter with a smile wide with teeth. He and his wife retired to a lakefront town called Manitowoc on the Wisconsin side of Lake Michigan. I have Gallagher's address and phone number right here. If he can't point the way to the wreck, nobody can.
Pitt came over and shook Perlmutter's hand and said warmly, You do good work, St. Julian. My congratulations on an extraordinary piece of research.
I'll drink to that,
said a happy Perlmutter, ignoring the tea and pouring another glass of the 40-year-old port. Now, Peter, Pitt said, focusing his eyes on Harper. My question to you is,
What if Chin Chang should return to the United States? Unless he goes completely insane, he would never come back. But if he does, he'd be arrested the minute he stepped off the plane and placed in a federal prison until his trial on at least 40 different charges, including mass murder. Pitt turned back to Perlmutter. St. Julian, you once mentioned a respected Chinese researcher you've worked with in the past who was interested in the Princess Douan.
Zhu Quan, China's most renowned historian and the author of several classic books on the different dynasties. I'll have you know I followed your instructions and did not contact him for fear he might alert Chin Chang.
Well, now you can feed him everything you've got except Ian Gallagher. And if Gallagher puts us in the ballpark, you can give that to Zhu Quan, too.
None of this makes sense, said Julia, puzzled. Why give away the art treasures by leading Chin Chang to them?
You and Peter, the INS, FBI, and the entire Justice Department want Chin Chang. And Chin Chang wants what is on board the wreck of the Princess Douan.
I catch your drift, said Harper. There is method to your madness. What you're saying is that Chin Chang is obsessed and will move heaven and earth to lay his hands on the missing art treasures, even risking arrest and exposure by sneaking back into the United States.
Why should he risk everything when he could just as well direct a salvage expedition from his headquarters in Hong Kong? Questioned Gunn.
I'll bet the bank the wreck haunts his dreams, and he wouldn't trust his mother to run the operation.
I checked the shipping registry. Chin Chang Maritime owns a salvage vessel. The minute he sniffs the Princess Douan's location, he'll send the ship and board it from Canada when it comes down the St. Lawrence River into the Great Lakes.
Aren't you afraid of him finding it first? Asked Julia.
Not to fear. We won't show our hand until we've salvaged the treasure first.
Finding it is only the first step. Salvaging the treasure will take a year, maybe more.
Sandecker looked doubtful.
You may be placing too much confidence in Gallagher to lead you to the wreck. He might have jumped ship before it vanished.
The Admiral has a point, said Gunn. If Gallagher knew the position of the sinking, he'd have tried to salvage it himself.
But he hasn't, Pitt said firmly, simply because the artifacts have never surfaced. St. Julian can tell you no one can cover up a treasure find. Whatever his reason, Gallagher has kept the location to himself, or St. Julian would have found a record of his attempt.
Sandecker looked mildly through the smoke of his cigar at Pitt.
How soon can you leave for Manitowoc?
I have your permission to go.
The Admiral winked at Harper. I think the INS will let Numa carry the ball until Chin Chang puts in an appearance.
You'll get no argument out of me, Admiral, said Harper cheerfully. He smiled at Julia.
You're due for a long rest, Julia, but I suspect you'll be happy to act as liaison between our two agencies during the search and salvage.
If you're asking me to volunteer, she said, restraining feelings of eagerness, the answer is an unqualified yes.
Any hint on what kind of guy Gallagher is? Pitt asked Perlmutter.
He must have been tough in his early days. His nickname of Hong Kong came from all the bars he wiped butt in while his ship was in port.
Then he's no pussycat. Perlmutter chuckled.
No, I don't guess he is.